Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's October 5th, and so it's the day that they're suggesting, you know, the world can't wait, folks, are suggesting that people basically...
You've got to say, I'm a human being! My life has value!
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Yeah, meetings happening all over the East Coast right at this moment. It's noon on October 5th. Welcome to the program. Coming up today, Andrew Gause is going to be with us in the second hour of the program, talking about the greenback bomb, a weapon of mass destruction that, in his opinion, China and Iran may have pointed at the United States. That's not what you think. And in the third hour of our program, Sasha Abramski is going to be with us. She's the author of Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. And Bill Morrison, who's running for Tennessee's 7th District in Congress, is going to be with us talking about that. Just a quick heads up, David Tebow of the conservative Cybercast News Service, who is a regular on our program and has been for the last couple of years. Those of you who listen regularly, you know that David he comes on here and debates with me. And David, about a month or two, a couple months ago, kind of dropped out for a while because his leukemia. He had cancer before. He got radiation treatment for it. As a consequence of that, he developed leukemia, and so he had to go in for chemotherapy. He was back on the program last week. We had a great conversation about the detainee bill, and he was going to be back on. We were scheduling him for this week or for early next week to discuss health care, in fact, and we were going to talk about his experience right now. He's looking for a bone marrow donor. And having a difficult time about it. There's a link on the homepage at tomhartman.com if you are interested in that whole process and in bone marrow donation or even helping out David. And and he was going to argue that we should not have a national health care system, and I was going to argue that we should. But he has an IV in to be able to administer the medications that are keeping him alive until he can find a bone marrow donor. And it got infected, and it went into his heart, and he's now in the intensive care unit at the hospital. So for those, I know a number of our listeners have contacted him in the past and sent him well wishes when they discovered that he was ill. I just wanted to give you a heads up on that. David is fighting for his life right now, so keep him in your prayers, please. David Limbaugh is with us. He has a new book out. It's called Bankrupt, The Intellectual and Moral Bankruptcy of Today's Democratic Party. David Limbaugh, a lawyer, a columnist, the brother of Rush Limbaugh, and living in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. I understand it's a beautiful place, David.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm great. I'm fine. Your book suggests that the Democratic Party is purposefully undermining this nation for the sake of advancing their liberal agenda. Let's deconstruct those two.
For the sake of advancing their partisan agenda.
Well, actually, I'm reading from the PR piece that
you
sent to
us. Yeah, well, I didn't write that. I mean, whatever. But anyway, that's close enough.
Yeah, all right. Purposefully undermining the nation. How?
Well, they're subordinating the national interest, is the way I prefer to call it, to their partisan interests. They're undermining President Bush's prosecution of the war on terror at every turn.
Well, for example.
Pardon?
Give me an example.
They mischaracterize his NSA terrorist tracking program as domestic spying when it always involves an international party to the conversation or communication. It always involves a terrorist or suspected terrorist. It is not a law enforcement matter. It is used to prevent terrorist attacks. It has prevented terrorist attacks.
Are you suggesting that George W. Bush spying on folks who are engaged in international communications, which is provided for under the FISA Act, where he does, he can go 3 days before he goes to the FISA court, that he should be allowed to break the law?
Oh, I don't accept the premise of your question. I don't think he is breaking the law.
Well, a court has ruled that he broke the law.
One court has ruled, a very partisan court. We'll see how it turns out. The court could go either way. I don't know.
Well, are you familiar with the law, David Limbaugh?
Yes.
Okay.
How can you
argue that he didn't break the law?
You got to let me talk now. If you're going to have a debate with me, you got to let me talk.
I didn't think I wasn't.
Well, we're not talking about. I don't believe that he did break the law. He doesn't believe he broke the law. His attorney general doesn't believe that he broke the law, that he has inherent constitutional authority and congressional authority to conduct these warrantless searches, and they don't believe it would be practical to do it otherwise.
Isn't the argument not that he didn't break the law, but that the law doesn't apply to him?
No.
Because of that inherent presidential authority?
Well, I mean,
because
the
language of the law, any federal officer who engages in surveillance must obtain within 3 days of the initiation of that surveillance a warrant from a FISA court. And he's a federal officer, and he failed to do that.
If the law doesn't apply to him, he's obviously not breaking it. But his position is that he has the inherent authority to do it. Retired FISA judges have agreed that he has inherent constitutional authority to do it. And there's an ongoing debate about it. But for you guys to act like it's a cut-and-dried case where he's deliberately trying to consolidate executive authority and aggregate power at the expense of the legislative branch, I think is, again, misrepresentation. He's trying to prevent future attacks. What motive would he have to not comply with a warrant requirement if he believed there were a warrant requirement? He's trying to prevent attacks. He's not trying to prosecute criminals, suspected drug enforcement guys.
Well, it's a really good question, David Limbaugh. And by the way, website davidlimbaugh.com and his new book, Bankrupt. It's a really good question, and I think that Richard Nixon answered it for us. Richard Nixon broke that. The law didn't exist at the time. The law came about as a result of Nixon. Nixon said, I've got the FBI and the CIA spying, and I'm not going to tell you who they're spying on, and I'm going to do it without a warrant, and I'm not going to notify a court. And it turned out that the reason why he was doing it was because he was spying on his political opponents. How do Democrats
know that
George W. I thought you were going to let me finish your sentence. How do Democrats know that George W. Bush isn't doing the exact same thing that was being done out of Republican offices in the Senate when they were spying on when they hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer? How do we know that he's not wiretapping us?
Well,
if
he is wiretapping us, there's remedies for it. And a guy can wiretap you. If you say he's going to break a law, he can break it without even talking about it. So, I mean, I've never understood that argument. A guy can violate the law all he wants to if he can get away with it. But we're talking about NSA people. We don't have the manpower to monitor little old ladies, and we don't have the motive or incentive to do it. We're talking about, and there have been no victims, no known victims. Senator Feinstein has admitted that. No victims of the Patriot Act. We're talking about prosecutorial tools that the Democrats are instinctively against.
If Hillary Clinton was president, would you want her to have the power to wiretap you without having to go to a court and demonstrate that there's some good reason to?
If I am suspected to be talking to a suspected terrorist, yes.
In Hillary Clinton's mind, not in the mind of a judge, but simply in her mind, then you think that she should be able to wiretap you.
It's not in her mind. She'd have to have a reasonable basis for it, and I would have a remedy.
But she would be the person who would determine what that reasonable basis was. And no, you wouldn't have a remedy because you'd never know about it.
Listen, Tom, it's not an irreversible situation. If I found out that that was occurring, I could take remedial action legally against her.
How are you going to find out?
Well, I don't know.
She's the president. She runs the executive branch.
Listen, how are you going to find out if anybody breaks the law doing anything? You're not. But we're getting bogged
down. Well, that's the reason why we have laws that prevent people from engaging in an activity where they.
Reasonable people disagree as to that law.
Okay, then if reasonable people are disagreeing, David Limbaugh, why do you say that Democrats are purposefully undermining the nation by having this discussion?
Because I think their purpose in preventing the enforcement of this act is to gain partisan points against President Bush.
My purpose in arguing for the enforcement of this act is to make sure that Hillary Clinton isn't listening on you and your brother.
No, I understand that people like you and can be, have a reasonable position on this. I'm talking about the Democratic leadership. That's what I believe. Now, let me give you some other examples so that I can build my case.
Okay, we just have 30 seconds. Dan.
Well,
sorry,
look how they've lied about Bush lying about WMD. They've lied about him saying Saddam was involved in 9/11 when he explicitly said otherwise. They've lied about him saying there was an operational relationship. They've lied about saying he's a unilateralist when he got 32 nations and begged other nations to join the coalition, which a unilateralist wouldn't have done. They have lied about him committing torture by policy at Gitmo when he hasn't. And when
do you think that any of those arguments are gonna fly with anybody outside of the Republican base?
Well, I absolutely do. I absolutely do.
Do you have another 15 minutes, David?
Pardon?
Excuse me. David, do you have another 15 minutes?
I don't have 15, but I'll go a few after that.
Yeah, well, we've got to take about a four-minute break here, and then we've got until 27 after the hour, if you can stick around. If you can.
Okay.
Great, cool. David Limbaugh is with us. His book, Bankrupt, The Intellectual and Moral Bankruptcy of Today's Democratic Party, 16 minutes past the hour in the Tom Hartman program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Chicken off.
Carl Rove.
He didn't serve.
Dick Cheney.
He didn't serve.
Tom DeLay.
He didn't serve.
And George Bush was AWOL.
Chicken off.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. We're talking with David Limbaugh's new book, Bankrupt, The Intellectual and Moral Bankruptcy of Today's Democratic Party. David, I understand we've got about 3 minutes. You got to run to catch a plane?
No, not a plane, but I got to go run to St. Louis and get on the satellite uplink. Go ahead.
Well, let's try to get beyond the sound bites here for just a second. I mean, you can say the Democratic Party.
You gave me 30 seconds. I was just trying to rush through.
I understand, and that's fine, and you did a good job of it. But it seems like an awful lot of this debate is happening at the surface. It's happening. Where he said, she said, Bush lied about the war. No, he didn't lie about the war. There were weapons of mass destruction. No, there weren't, blah, blah, blah. And I can play his sound bites and you can play me sound bites and we can beat each other up, all afternoon and it'll just be silly theater. But it seems to me that the fact of the matter is there's something really fundamental going on here underneath this all. And that is the fundamental and foundational difference that has existed for the better part of 100 years between the Republican and the Democratic Party, or between, let's say, conservatives and liberals. And what really is going on is the Republican Party's effort to roll back the New Deal and the Democratic Party's, part of the Democratic Party's effort to revive the New Deal, and part of the Democratic Party's, frankly, the DLC part of the Democratic Party's effort to go along with the Republicans on this. I mean, as your brother pointed out,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
It's really about destroying, privatizing Social Security, doing away with minimum wage laws, doing away with unemployment compensation, doing away with national health care or the possibility of it, and privatizing our schools, isn't it? I mean, isn't it really about the philosophical differences here?
Absolutely. On the domestic side, there is certainly that debate. However, Bill Clinton, as you know, was dragged kicking and screaming to the third time pass welfare reform, and he is your guy's icon and your partner.
Yeah, I am not a defender of Bill Clinton. That right there in the dust.
But the party's icon. He's still the party's icon.
I would say he's very powerful in the party. I'd say there's a lot of people in the party who think that Bill Clinton did a lot of good things and a lot of things that were just a shame.
Right. You're right. There are still strong philosophical differences. I wish that liberals would be open about their liberalism. John Kerry in 2003 recently took umbrage when the National Journal designated him as the most liberal voting senator. He won't admit he's a liberal. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
I think it's a tragedy.
Pardon?
I think it's a tragedy that John Kerry wouldn't call himself a liberal.
You sound like a bona fide, intellectually honest liberal, and you've got to be disgusted by some of these guys who won't admit their liberalism. And there's a tug of war going on in your party. I don't know if you're a Democrat, but I mean,
I'm not a Democrat, but I support the Democratic Party. And yes, there is a tug of war going on in the Democratic Party.
There is in ours too, for totally different reasons, mostly immigration and domestic spending.
So how do we change the conversation in America from basically saying you're anti-American, no, you're anti-American, to hey, let's have a rational discussion about whether or not we should have a national health care program in this country.
Tom, I think that would be wonderful, and I welcome it, and I know you won't believe this, and this all boils down to our different worldviews, which happens to be, and what you were alluding to that a minute ago, but it happens to affect who we believe and who we trust, too, unfortunately. And I happen to believe, honestly, I could pass a polygraph here, that Democrats, the leadership of the party, has deliberately lied in so many respects about President Bush, and to the point that we can't have an honest debate. They're trying to avoid an honest debate. I mean, I can't tell you how much it bothers me that they've held him up to the world as commander-in-chief, as a liar, as a guy who would lie about the things that matter most, when everyone knows that's intellectually honest that he believed, as did everyone else, that almost everyone else, besides Dennis Kucinich, that Iraq had WMD.
And I don't think he believed that.
Oh, man, I find it unbelievable.
I'm sorry, I've listened to Colin Powell. Colin Powell says, you know, that Bush didn't believe that the information was there, that it was ambiguous.
The committee...
I trust Colin Powell more than I do George Bush.
Well, see, there we go. It's back to what I said, who you trust.
But see, that's why we have to have the rule of law. Because if you and I are agreeing that politicians cannot be trusted, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, then why would you want a president having the power to designate you or me as an enemy combatant and disappear us the way Pinochet did in Chile? Why would you support that legislation that passed the Senate last week?
We're at war, and the president...
We're not at war with the American people.
Well, no, and you don't find any American citizens being victims of this thing.
It could happen.
Yeah, of course it could happen. But we shouldn't be
in a situation where it could happen. It should be illegal.
Ourselves. But you guys reflexively side against the prosecutorial tools to fighting this war. We have actually prevented attacks by tough interrogation techniques. This bill that came out that the Democrats opposed specifically, explicitly forbids torture. But the techniques that they used against these terrorists actually saved, arguably, thousands of lives. And yet you guys fall.
Would you want your children to be subject, if they were in the U.S. military and they were taken captive in another country, to those same techniques?
That's such a false argument, because the terrorists are going to behead us. See, we talk about torture. What we do...
So we should just become like the terrorists.
Pardon?
So we should just become like the terrorists.
No, and I didn't say that, did I? The bill explicitly forbids torture. And with just tough techniques, completely different.
We have to wrap it up. Interesting conversation. David Limbaugh's new book, Bankrupt, The Intellectual and Moral Bankruptcy of Today's Democratic Party. DavidLimbaugh.com, the website. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The latest news has struck me funny. It's all about greed, boys, and it's all about money. Well, this great nation is in distress. I've got to get something off of my chest. November's coming, and it won't be long. When you cast your vote, please don't vote wrong. Vote away those blues, Republican blues.
And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour, announcing the October Surprise Contest over at the Tom Hartman Program message blogs. First person to post on our message board the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll so members can vote on the winner, and four runners-up each will receive an autographed copy of Screwed, and the winner will be announced November 14th, when we can all look back retrospectively and see who was the accurate prognosticator. Speaking of the question, one of the questions that Limbaugh raised in our debate a few minutes ago, why would George Bush want to do these things if it wasn't to protect America? Why would he want to aggregate all of this this power if it wasn't to... why would he want to wiretap people without a warrant if it wasn't to protect us? You have to trust Daddy, you know. Well, the Congressional Research Service. This is a research branch of the United States Congress which is not beholden to any political party. People who work in the Congressional Research Service are hired for their ability to do research. They are not partisan appointments. They are, you know, career bureaucrats. I mean, basically, they're people who this is their job, this is what they do. Regardless of who's president, regardless of who's in power, they simply tell the truth. And they just issued a report saying that George W. Bush's frequent use of signing statements, this is from thinkprogress.org, by the way, is an integral part of his comprehensive strategy. This, I'm quoting from the Congressional Research Service report now. It's an integral part of his comprehensive strategy to strengthen and expand executive power, to inure Congress, as well as others, to the belief that the president, in fact, possesses expansive and exclusive powers upon which the other branches may not intrude. In other words, end of quote, by the way. In other words, he's trying to make himself king. King George. And it just seems to me that this is a very, very, very dark day for America. A very bad thing for American democracy. In the meantime, today, the Justice Department has successfully initiated an appeal of Bush's warrantless domestic wiretap program, his what he calls his terrorist surveillance program, what is really his violation of the FISA law, that he can continue to break that law until the another judge appeals in the or an appeals court. It's probably going to be a three or nine judge panel in an appeals court in Cincinnati, rules on whether or not what Bush has done is illegal. So they bought some time. And in the meantime, I think it's really important, you know, that we never forget some of the really outrageous statements that George W. Bush knew were not factual. We know now. I mean, from the Downing Street memo to Colin Powell to Bob Woodward, we know that George W. Bush knew that there was a good chance there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And people in these cons, they come out and they say, oh, everybody knew it. The French knew it. The Germans knew it. The Russians knew it. The Chinese knew it. No, all those folks were actually outside of the British, because Tony Blair wanted a war, too. He thought he was going to have a Margaret Thatcher moment, you know, when she had her war in the Falkland Islands and she suddenly became so popular. Blair and Bush both thought this was going to be a Falkland Island kind of thing. Outside of Tony Blair, all the rest of Europe was saying, wait a second, we've got inspectors in there. We would like to hear what the inspectors have to say. And it's just amazing to me how often the national mainstream media gives a pass to cons who go on their programs and say, oh, well, Bush wasn't the only one who thought they had weapons of mass destruction. Everybody in the world thought they had weapons of mass destruction. No, I'm sorry. Everybody in the world thought that it was possible that they had weapons of mass destruction, but it looked increasingly like they didn't, because that was the feedback that was coming back from Hans Blix. And yet this is what Bush was saying.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And at the time he was saying this, he knew it was untrue.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
In fact, Bush even suggested that using Hussein's balsa wood hobby airplane, that Iraq might attack the United States.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yeah. Saddam Hussein was threatening the United States, and therefore we had to attack him first. It's the exact same argument that Hitler made about Poland. And all of Europe was in an uproar about it. Prove to us that Poland has weapons of mass destruction. Oh, they've got poison gas, said Hitler. They're massing it on the border. We don't see any poison gas. Oh, yeah, it's there. And then all hell broke loose. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Carl in St. Joe, Michigan. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Well, I heard your comment, or your guest comment, Mr. Limbaugh.
Yeah.
He's like his brother. He ain't got no sense, and he's probably in the same boat as far as drugs go. But he's trying to make the liberals as being the bad guys. That was done by Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
The only thing is, it's not the C word or the liberal word that's bad. It's the C word. You look at everything today. The conservatives, fooling around with kids and all that stuff. They want to make liberals bad.
That's not a kid. But see, like, come on, Carl. That pedophilia is not a conservative position either.
How many Democrats in Congress are being caught that way? If they are, they ought to be kicked out.
Well, I agree with you. But the point is not that particular scandal. The point is that what this is all about is that Republicans want to roll back the New Deal. They want to undo Social Security. They want to undo unemployment insurance. They want to do away with the minimum wage. They want to undo maximum hour laws. They want to do away with the unions in the United States. They have a very specific domestic agenda. Very, very clear and very specific. And they use demonization of those of us who would defend that agenda as a technique, as a tool, as a political weapon. And that, I think, is wrong. And that's what I was trying to call him on.
Well, I understand that. But the thing is, he gets on there and he puts out his screwy ideas, and I mean, which is fine. But the other thing, the point I make is, it's not only the New Deal that Roosevelt had. It was a New Frontier with Jack Kennedy. Even though he didn't live long.
Well, and it was the square deal with Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, there have been a series of times in this country when we have rolled back conservative administrations. We did it in 1900 with Teddy Roosevelt, and he was a Republican. Rolled back a lot of the opening up of the market is what they called it back during the age of the robber barons.
Great.
And then Franklin Roosevelt rolled back the excesses of the Roaring Twenties. And now it's time to roll back the excesses of the Reagan to Bush era, because just a whole lot of damage has been done to this country. Carl, thanks for the call. I got to move along here. Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom, quickly. I mean, you're the only one that gets it, what the real core of the debate is about demolishing the New Deal. But it gets even deeper than that, Tom. They have bought the Ayn Rand concept that a system of governance of democracy is subservient to a laissez-faire economic system. I wish you would get even deeper to that, to him, to say you don't even believe in democracy.
Well, but see, then he would say, yes, I do, and then
no, and then you're off to the races in the debate, and that's and let him defend that he really supports democracy, because he can't. That is the core. You got close with the New Deal, but it's even deeper, like the Ayn Rand.
Okay, well, we'll keep at it, Tom.
I know you agree with me on that.
Yeah, no, I do. I absolutely do, and like I said, we will keep at it. Rick in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Rick.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
If you will indulge me one moment, this seems like such a small point, but it's so important to me. Several times I've heard, even recently in your interview just a moment ago, the concept of we're at war. We have to do this. We've allowed liberals in this country to portray Bush as a liar when we're at war. We're not at war.
No, we're not.
It's never been declared. It is an operation, and every time we...
It's an occupation, actually.
We as conservatives, as liberals or conservatives, use that word, we empower the fear that they're putting out, that conservatives and fundamentalists who by the definition of the word, understand only small things, we allow them to believe we're at war.
I absolutely agree with you, Rick. And in fact, that's why I wrote an op-ed piece. It was published in Common Dreams. You can find it over at tomhartmann.com. Click Articles on Democracy about 3 months ago, saying we need to stop using the word war. We need to point out to the extent that we had a war against Iraq, it ended on May 1st when Bush got on that aircraft carrier and correctly declared that we had won the war because we had taken out a government. We had seized their buildings. We had seized their infrastructure. We had overthrown their leaders. We had control of the country. That's the end of a war. What began at that point in Iraq was the occupation of Iraq. Same thing in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan lasted about a week, maybe two. It's been an occupation ever since then, and the occupation has been broadly, terribly unsuccessful. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Lonely feeling deep inside. Find the corner where I can hide. Silent footsteps crowding me. Sudden darkness, but I can see.
And welcome back to the radio support group of by and for we the people of the United States of America. Just a heads up, tomorrow night I'll be at Town Hall in Seattle giving a rant about the middle class and signing my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. It's sponsored by Elliott Bay Book Company, and tickets are $5 in advance at Elliott Bay, and that's just basically to pay for the rent of the Town Hall. And for more information on that event, you can call Elliott Bay at 206-624-6600 to pick up your tickets. Should be a lot of fun, and there's going to be a lot of good people there. And I'm looking forward to it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Tom, have you heard about the put options for Friday? I learned about it myself from Lynn Samuels.
Yeah, I was talking about it I don't think we got into it on the national program, on the local program a couple of days ago, that there were all these puts for tomorrow on commodities and other things. A couple of people who were, and because I didn't have a Fidelity account or whatever, I don't have one of these online brokerage accounts, so I couldn't actually check, but apparently people who do can. And so a couple of our listeners who are active investors went in and checked and said, no, there's nothing weird going on that they could tell.
I'm looking at freemarketnews.com. The title is Repost Up. Puts forecast October surprise.
Yeah, but puts don't expire on the first Friday of the week. They typically expire on the third Friday of the week, I believe. I could be wrong, but
yeah, I don't understand the timing of that myself. And everyone knows about stuff like this because of United Airlines and American and Morgan Stanley before 9/11.
Right.
Why don't you explain to us, if they put the put option for the 6th, what time frame do they have to actually cash out on
right? And see, here's the thing. I mean, if I thought that the Bush administration was, the Sixth Fleet is steaming into the Gulf of Arabia, and I thought that they were going to do something, so the October surprise was going to be that they were going to bomb Iran, I would not be buying puts. I'd be buying calls. I would be betting that the price of gold and oil would be going up. On the other hand, maybe I'd be buying puts on the Fortune 500 because that's, during 9/11 they all fell. But this story has morphed from its puts on stocks to now it's puts on commodities. And I, as far as I can tell, I just can't find anything to back it up.
All right, well, so, I'm glad to hear someone like yourself isn't worried about it.
Yeah, well, it's not that I'm not worried about it. It's just I haven't been able to find anything to back it up. If somebody who knows more than you and I do, Jay, who is listening right now, and actually can find something, let us know, and we'll track it down. Bob in Winchester, Virginia. Hey, Bob, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I heard you talking about the consolidation of power in the executive branch.
Yeah.
And didn't Rumsfeld and Cheney both work for Nixon?
Yeah, they did. Well, actually, for Jerry Ford. Rumsfeld was his Secretary of Defense, and Cheney was his Chief of Staff. And
And
the whole consolidation of power thing, I think it might be summarized well here by George Bush.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
And it's almost like he was telling us what was coming.
Right, right. Because, that's the thing that just you know, I can just imagine these guys sitting around, you know, yearning for the old days when, you know, they're consolidating power, they're creating this imperial presidency, and all of a sudden the whole thing falls apart on them.
Yeah.
And then now all of a sudden they say, well, we have another chance, another good chance to do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's one of the, I mean, it's just, when I was listening to Limbaugh, I mean, I was just enraged because, I mean, he's debating with you. And he's saying things that are just, you know, that the president never implied that there was an imminent threat.
Yeah, no, and that's why, I mean, you know, he went through his list there at the end of the first
segment.
Right, I just let him finish it because I didn't, you know, it really didn't even occur to me that any of my listeners would seriously consider those a legitimate argument.
That's why
when he was done, I said, do you really think anybody other than a hardcore Republican base is going to believe that stuff?
That's it, absolutely not. And the thing is I think what, you know, the thing I think these guys miss, it's not just the left now. It's spread no matter who I speak to.
It's average Americans right across the board.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People are sitting saying, I don't know where my country's gone, but the country that I grew up to believe in didn't sponsor torture, didn't start preemptive wars, didn't do any of these things. And then when you said to him, well, what about soldiers in future wars? He goes, well, the terrorists are going to cut their heads off. We're not talking about the war on terror, the so-called war on terror.
No, it's a diversion with talking points. Bob, I got to run along, but I appreciate the call. Thank you. Robert in Staten Island, New York, because we got a whole mess of calls here. Hey, Robert.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I'm calling because you were talking earlier about the wiretapping issues and so forth. And I recall right after 9/11, there was a vote coming up in the UN, and the local Verizon had tapped the UN lines and fed the information out to the Bush administration so they can determine how different countries were going to vote. I don't remember what the vote was. But
the vote was on Resolution 1440, on whether or not to authorize the United Nations to use force in Iraq.
Okay. And now you had mentioned that, you know, this type
of... And yes, the Bush administration did illegally wiretap the UN, and no, there has never been an investigation held because no Republican in the House or Senate was willing to call for one.
Exactly. And now we're passing a law to allow him to do this, hoping he'll do it for the right reasons. And in my opinion, that was not one of the right reasons.
No, I agree with you. And that's and if he'll wiretap, you know, if he'll wiretap the vote in the UN, why wouldn't he wiretap the vote in Congress? And in fact, they already did. Republicans have already hacked into, I mean, they admitted it. Orrin Hatch's office, he fired his chief of staff because he found that the guy had hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer. And but it was after you know, it all came out, right? I mean, this was like three, four years ago. It was around, you know, federal judgeships. Robert, thanks for the call, and thanks for reminding us, bringing that out of the memory hole. It's amazing how much has happened and how much we've forgotten has happened. 56 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, sometimes you know what you know. Welcome back, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, the second hour of our program. Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know that you don't even know what you don't know, but you need to know it.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Is it possible that the weapon of mass destruction that's going to be used against the United States has nothing to do with chemical, biological, or nuclear agents? Andrew Goss is with us. He is the author of a new book, The Secret World of Money. He is also runs a newsletter, The World of Money Newsletter. Their number is 800-878-2646. I'll give that again at the end of this segment. And you have a website, Andrew?
I do. It's andygosse.com.
Great. Before we get into this whole greenback bomb thing, just a quick question. There's been this rumor flying around the internet that there's a zillion puts out there. In one version of it, it's for commodities like gold and oil. In another version of it, it's for, you know, major Fortune 500 traded stocks that are scheduled to expire or to be exercised tomorrow on October 6th. Any truth to that?
Well, you know, the idea that the so-called witching hours, you know, the triple witching when contracts expire will have dramatic effect. It's certainly been around for a while, so I couldn't really comment on it one way or the other.
Okay, so you're not aware of a specific one. I've been unable to corroborate it as well. So
yeah.
Now, you're suggesting here in your newsletter and in your new book, The Greenback Bomb, that in The Secret World of Money, the bomb that they intend to use against us is dropping the dollar as the main means of exchange for oil.
Right.
Okay. Explain to us how this works. Why is it that the entire world is paying, or most of the world is paying for oil with dollars when most of the world doesn't use dollars doesn't issue dollars as their currency? Why does China, which uses the yuan, most of Europe, which uses the euro, South America, different, you know, currencies, why do they have to buy oil in dollars?
Well, it was the only thing we asked for out of World War II. It didn't make sense to a lot of folks. You know, we didn't want, as most traditional nations asked for, reparations. You know, forced the conquered nations, Germany and Japan, and Italy, to pay the cost of war.
After World War I, there was the Treaty of Versailles.
There certainly were reparations then. That was the tradition. And, in fact, many suspected that America would do the very same thing coming out of World War II, but we didn't. We said the opposite. Here's the Marshall Plan. We'll give you money to rebuild Europe. We'll loan money all over the place. All that we want is that every time anyone buys a barrel of oil, they pay for it with dollars. And so...
And the advantage to us in that was...
Well, the advantage to us was... non-existent, but the advantage to the Federal Reserve was that it provided an interest-free loan, in effect.
Now, let's back up for just a second here. We're talking 1946,
right?
And at that time, the United States was one of the world's largest oil-exporting countries.
That's right.
So you could argue that there would be an advantage to oil being denominated in dollars simply because the oil barons might have wanted that as much as the Fed wanted it.
Well, certainly the way that it played out is to the Fed's advantage. You know, if we fast forward to today, there are about $2 trillion sloshing around in the rest of the world that never, ever compete for goods and services here at home. They only compete in the international oil markets, and they're stored in various accounts throughout the world, again, never competing for goods and services here at home.
Now, how does that inure benefit to the Federal Reserve, acknowledging right up front here that the Federal Reserve is not federal and it's not a reserve, that it's essentially a private bank sanctioned by the U.S. government, owned by its 12 member banks, which are owned by smaller private banks in the various states. So
yeah.
If I buy stock in Chittenden Bank in Montpelier, Vermont, for example, which is a FDIC bank,
you become a holder of the Federal Reserve.
That's right. So why is this private corporation that controls our money, that is theoretically issued by the Treasury, why do they have an advantage or a benefit from there being $2 trillion in circulation on the planet that's not being used here?
Well, it represents a loan. Remember, the Federal Reserve creates that money. And without backing in gold or silver. So it represents $2 trillion that they were effectively allowed to create and send into circulation without having the political ramifications of...
But how do they recover interest on that? I mean, the fact that that China is accumulating dollars to buy oil from the Saudis, I can understand how that could have an impact here in the United States in that eventually those dollars have to come back, and when they do, they end up buying, you know, large chunks of American infrastructure. We're seeing the selling off of America as a result of our trade deficit.
Exactly.
But how does it in your benefit, you know, where does the Fed is getting interest on it? How?
Well, because it originated from a bond issued either by the United States or a debt instrument of some kind. Someone issued a debt instrument to get that money into circulation. And it was the Federal Reserve that created the money and offset that instrument. So on the net side, they're holding debt instruments for every dollar that they create. So it effectively represents $2 trillion in money I mean, let's face it.
Now, what about M3? I thought that they could simply create. I thought the Fed, the Treasury Department could, or the Fed in collaboration with the Treasury Department could simply print money.
That's right, and this represents $2 trillion that they've created or printed that doesn't affect domestic inflation because
but,
it doesn't.
Right, right. But I mean, they can create money without having to have reserves against. I mean, you know, domestically, yes, I go to my bank. And they have $10 on reserve. They can loan me $100. $90 just got manufactured out of thin air.
Right.
But, again, I don't see how the dollar being the current. You know, I get it how this has happened, and that this has happened. And I get it that if all the countries of the world suddenly decided they didn't need dollars anymore, those dollars would start coming back home to America, and the value of the dollar would fall through the floor.
Right.
And we would have, in other words, we would have huge inflation, massive inflation.
Yeah, because they're really not dollars what these folks are holding. What they're holding are treasury instruments. They're holding
right.
debt instruments.
So what's the weapon of mass destruction? How is it that China and Iran, you suggest that China and Iran might use this against us, or perhaps already are?
Yeah.
How?
I mean, well, you look, China has $600 billion worth of treasury bonds accumulated, and a simple disgorging of those treasury bonds would force the Federal Reserve to create $600 billion or allow China to effectively suck up all the dollars in the money market, which would definitely drive interest rates up and maybe cause a recession here at home. So it's more likely, in my view, that they'll simply create another $600 billion and give it to China in exchange for its treasury bonds. And it's not just China. Venezuela and others have started disgorging themselves.
Right, but $600 billion isn't an enormous amount of money. I mean, we've spent $500 billion in Iraq.
I know. And, so, and it's funny that we didn't reach our first $1 trillion in circulation until 1980. So, yeah, I mean, at this point in the game, with a total money supply of something around $11 trillion, the argument is, well, $600 billion is not that great a deal. It's, you know, a minor fraction in the overall scheme of things. But if you start now erasing that benefit, so if we have that, you know, as you mentioned, financing our existence on the trade deficit, and larger portion of it is oil, and if we start now not being able to have the people that we buy the oil from holding on to the dollars, but rather recycling them right back into the U.S. economy as fast as they get them, then we're going to start to see higher rates of inflation than we have been in the last 25 years.
Is this what you're expecting, Andrew, or is this what you're saying might happen?
No, this is what I'm expecting, in fact.
And therefore, what kind of investment strategy should people follow?
Well, as much as...
Or life policy, for that matter. A lot of people don't have the means for investment.
As don't save money. I think the three worst things you could do would be to save your money, pay off your debts early, and live debt-free.
Those are the three worst things you can do?
In my scenario. If,
okay.
Because
dollars, if you're deeply in debt, you're going to pay that debt off with inflated dollars.
Dollars that are worth substantially less, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So you're suggesting what? That people buy physical commodities?
Yeah, I like physical commodities of all sorts. I collect old gold coins, so that's my thing. But real estate, art, antiques, old items. What did that Andy Warhol painting go for last night? I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
Items like that will... that you can always trade for higher quantities of dollars. That's probably the best investment for the next 10 years.
Get yourself out of dollars as quickly as possible.
And I hate to put it that way because we all are all of us are shareholders. Every dollar that you hold.
But the one thing in terms of increasing your own personal debt, though, I would think the last thing you'd want to do is get into an adjustable rate mortgage.
You got that right. Yeah, you don't want to rent money if you're going to buy a house. If you're going to buy a house, buy the money as well. You know, get a fixed payment schedule on a fixed rate mortgage. You don't want to rent the money because the cost of money, I'm sure, will increase.
But should people mortgage to the max in their house, or should they try to own their house and just be free of that whole system?
Well, you know, there is that school of thought, and if you're going to be completely out of the system and you're not going to save dollars now, then
you're just saving the house. Then that's a good thing too.
Yeah, pay off your house, then don't save any money. That's
right.
A good
but don't get. In other words, I guess the lesson is don't get in between. Either go all the way one way or the other.
Exactly right.
Interesting. Andrew Goss, World of Money Newsletter, 800-878-2646. The website is worldofmoney.com, was it, Andrew?
Yeah, that one will work, or andygoss.com. Yep.
Or andygoss, G-A-U-S-E.com. Andy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to Listener Supported Radio. No monthly fees. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you by Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532. SacredGroundsCoffee.com. And by the way, they have a special deal right now. If you plug the word fall, F-A-L-L, as in autumn, into your, as you're checking out, into the checkout, into the coupon field at checkout, you get a 15% discount at SacredGroundsCoffee.com. Or Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. SmallDog.com. Their website. And the Organic Wine Company. 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECO, E-C-O-W-I-N-E. 1-888-ECO-WINE for organic French wine. Amazing stuff. Boy, there's a, just this amazing... Speaking of the Fed, yesterday, Ben Bernanke gave a speech in which he tried to pull one of the slickest tricks. I'm telling you, this when you go back to, and this, I mean, in a way, this goes back to the debate that David Limbaugh and I were having in the first hour of this program, when I pointed out that his brother had said,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And pointed out that what Limbaugh was saying, both Limbaughs, is that it's all about rolling back the New Deal. That's the Republican agenda. The Republican agenda is to destroy unions, to do away with a minimum wage, to do away with unemployment insurance, to do away with a social safety net, to privatize Social Security, to maintain a privatized health care system in the United States and not allow a possibility of a public health care system, of single-payer health care, for example, to do away with worker safety laws, to do away with environmental protections, all of these things that they consider socialism and big government, to do away with all these programs. And David Limbaugh, to his credit, said, yeah, that's what we're all about. That's the Republican domestic agenda. And how dare those nasty Democrats attack us? Well, the reality is that the Republicans, and it's not even really just the Republicans, because there are Democrats who are up to this as well. So let's call them the conservatives. The conservatives who are in favor of rolling back the New Deal, who want to end welfare as we know it, who want to freeze the minimum wage, who want to maintain so-called corporate free trade, international corporate free trade, or global free trade. Those conservatives know that they cannot sell to the American people their bill of goods. They can't do it honestly. So they have to do it dishonestly. And this is what Ben Bernanke did yesterday, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. He gave a speech in which he said that, well, here's this is the story from the Associated Press. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said Wednesday the burden from retiring baby boomers will strain the nation's budget and economy unless Social Security and Medicare are revamped. Reforming our unsustainable entitlement program should be a priority, Bernanke told the Washington Economic Club. The imperative is to undertake reform earlier rather than later. The imperative to undertake reform earlier rather than later is great. And then they point out in the article, government spending for Social Security and Medicare alone will increase from 7% of the U.S. economy to almost 13% by 2030 and to more than 15% by 2050. For instance, if the government tried to finance projected entitlement spending entirely by revenue increases, taxes would have to rise from 18% of the total size of the economy right now to 24% in 2030. So here's the false argument. This is a sucker's bet that this guy is selling. First of all, the Social Security system is solvent. The Social Security system is solid. Thank you. The Social Security system with no adjustment, no calibration, nothing being done to it whatsoever. The Social Security system is fine for the next 40 years. And with a very, very small tweaking, it'll be fine forever. Medicare, on the other hand, is a problem. And the reason Medicare is a problem is because we have a privatized health insurance program here in the United States. And that privatized health insurance, health care program here in the United States, or health system in the United States, is doubling every year. Not doubling, but it's rising in costs
at about twice the rate of inflation. Now, we are paying, on average, the average American is paying about $11,000 to $12,000 per year for health care. When you take the total health care budget and you divide it by the population. Every other country in the world is paying less than $6,000 per citizen. And yet we are not the healthiest country in the world. We're like number 26 on most indices. So why would we even have this? Well, because it's profitable for the health insurance companies and for folks like Bill Frist's daddy, who has become a billionaire because of this privatized health insurance program. So Medicare, yeah, it does need to be fixed. The way it needs to be fixed is we need to say Medicare for all, put the entire health insurance industry out of business. Those people can find other jobs someplace else. And let's have a single-payer health care system. The cost of health care in this country will drop in half. And then you don't have to worry about the fact that the boomers are retiring and it's going to cost more money, because it's not going to cost more money. It's going to cost less money. Social Security is run at 1/20th the cost of private pension programs, and yet it has never failed to write a check. We could do the same thing with the national health care system. But that's not what Bernanke wants to sell. What he wants to sell is privatization. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Speaking of the rich and the poor, which is really what Bernanke was saying yesterday, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed. Well, actually, let me scroll back to the first segment of this hour when I was interviewing Andrew Gause. He's suggesting fundamentally that people should put all of their money into physical things, into commodities, pay off your house, or, for all practical purposes, don't have a house, that is, be totally in debt. He's suggesting that people invest in commodities, gold, oil, things like that, things that are physical, antiques. He likes gold coins. I just wanted to say, I'm not offering investment advice here, and I, frankly, don't know what's best. I just want to just put that right out there. You know, what he's saying makes sense to me. But if I was betting my entire future on it, I'm grateful that I have a job, because we are going into very unstable economic times. That I know for sure. How to deal with it, what to do about it, I don't. There's some common sense stuff, but probably the number one common sense thing is do not have an adjustable rate mortgage. But beyond that, I just want to let Andrew's stuff stand on its own. Speaking of rich and poor, Link TV is going to broadcast a four-hour special called Inequality in America, Rich and Poor, Inequality in America, Friday, tomorrow night, October 6th, Wednesday, October 11th, and Saturday, October 28th, beginning at 5 p.m. Pacific or 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you will find a whole bunch of folks in it, selections from Robert Greenwald's Walmart, The High Cost of Low Prices, Inequality Matters, a speech by Bill Moyers. A wonderful guy. Had a nice conversation with Bill Moyers yesterday, in fact. And I'm in it. I'm about 20 minutes of it, about the death of the middle class. So you might find that interesting. Thought I'd give you a heads up that that's coming down the road. Anyhow, this is so transparent to those of us who have some sense of what's going on with regard to the conservative agenda. And it's so important, I believe, that we all be sharing this with everybody we know in a way that they can understand it, in a way that makes sense to everybody. That the conservative agenda here
And keep in mind, these are people, by and large, yes, there are some nasties in the group, just like there are on the left, frankly. But by and large, these are people who consider themselves patriots and who love America and who think that they're doing the best thing for this country. And they have, you know, they've read Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged, or they've somehow bought into this idealistic notion that if government just got out of the way, then everything would be fine. The corporations and the noble capitalists would take care of us all. And they really believe that. Many of them. I mean, yes, there are predators among them who just say, hey, you know, I'm going to get everything I can as quick as I can. You know, the Rockefellers of the world. But I think that many of these conservatives are doing it out of what they believe noble motive, and we have to acknowledge that. And they're going at it full tilt boogie. They believe that Social Security is a bad thing because it's a form of socialism. They believe that a single-payer health care system is a bad thing. They think it's a form of socialism. They think that if you just force people to stand on their own two feet, they will. And more people will work, and they'll work harder, and America will be more productive. And they don't realize that this is all happening on a substrate of a set of laws. That we establish the rules of the game of economics here in the United States, and in every country in the world for that matter. And every single time in the history of the country, in the history of the United States, and for that matter around the world, every single time their way has been used, it has led to many, many more poor people, the wealthy getting vastly wealthier, and an economic disaster. We saw it in the late 1800s. We saw it in the early 1900s. We've seen it again since Ronald Reagan. But nonetheless, they're going to continue trying to push this thing, and they are selling an empty box, basically. They're saying we need to reform Social Security and Medicare. Well, number one, there's nothing wrong with Social Security. It just needs a small tweaking, and it doesn't need that for decades. Medicare, yeah, you've got a big problem there. Why? Because Medicare is plugged into a for-profit system for healthcare. Healthcare should be a right, not a privilege, and healthcare in the United States, by and large, should be a non-profit system, not a for-profit system. This is how it works in most of the rest of the world, and it works very well, thank you very much. If we did one single thing, roll Social Security and Medicare together, and say everybody in the country is eligible for both, and do away with the caps, so that, because right now you only pay a tax, a Social Security tax, you only pay into these funds up to the first $90,000 of income every year. So if somebody makes $1 million, they pay Social Security tax on their first $90,000, and on their second $90,000, their third $90,000, their fourth $90,000, the rest of that million on the other $910,000. They pay no tax, no Social Security tax. If they make $10 million, they pay taxes on $90,000 of that dollars, and on $9,910,000 of it, they pay no Social Security tax whatsoever. So if we simply said we're going to make it a flat tax, you know that thing that Steve Forbes is running around talking about? Flat tax. Bill Gates pays the same tax rate I do. So somebody making billions is paying the exact same tax rate as somebody who's making under $90,000 a year or whatever it may be. If we simply did that, it would solve the problem of Medicare. And then you combine the two, and then you turn Medicare into a single-payer health care system for everybody in the United States and allow Medicare to start negotiating for prices. In other words, Medicare is your health insurance company. It is your Blue Cross Blue Shield. And you can still go to a private doctor, and the bill will be paid by Medicare. And require that hospitals and care providers be nonprofit corporations. They can still be private, but go back to the way it was in the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s in the United States, where hospitals are required to be not-for-profit corporations, so that their first goal is not to make a profit. Their first goal is to keep people alive, to provide good health care. If you simply did those things, doctors could still make a good living. The drug companies are still able to, although they're going to have to negotiate with a giant government, a giant purchaser. Drug prices are going to come down. The cost of care, of hospitalization is going to come down. Why? And health care is going to go away. Health insurance, rather. Because you've got, I mean, here you've got the president of the second largest health insurance company in the United States last year was paid $1.5 billion for 1 year's work. $1.5 billion for 1 year's work. What is wrong with this picture? Bill Frist's daddy is one of the 100 richest men in America because he and his family took, as counties and states made it legal for hospitals and healthcare facilities to be for-profit, they took not-for-profit, county-run, county-owned facilities and flipped them for-profit and started squeezing the blood out of them. Or squeezing the profits out of them. I guess that's a lousy metaphor for the healthcare. Maybe it's the perfect metaphor for healthcare. So all we have to do is combine Medicare with Social Security and say everybody is eligible for both of them. Flat tax. Don't raise the tax. Just let everybody pay. Right? Millionaires and billionaires start paying the Social Security tax like all the rest of us, like working people are in America. If you simply did that, you will have a system which will provide health care for everybody in the United States. High-quality health care, the highest quality, in fact, in the world. Because it would be better funded than any other country in the world. Just at the current level of taxation. And you'd have a Social Security system that will be solvent forever. That's what the conservatives don't want you to know. That with a stroke, and this is what they're so afraid of the Democrats taking control of the House, the Senate, and the White House. Because this is what Harry Truman tried to do in 1947. He proposed a single-payer health care system as part of Social Security. What I am suggesting, what I am laying out here is what Harry Truman tried to do. But in the election of 46, the Republicans had taken the House and the Senate, and they said, no. This is not going to happen. This is not going to get through Congress. And what we need is a strong Democratic majority in the House, the Senate, and in the White House in 2008. And we can put this country back together again. And we can be a nation where there are not people who are living in the streets. Not by choice. Where people are not dying for lack of health care. Where people are not working two and three jobs because they simply have to pay for their health insurance. Or where half of all bankruptcies aren't caused by people getting sick. Where three-quarters of them have health insurance. I mean, we can change this. We can transform this. This is not rocket science. This is very simple stuff. That's why the cons are doing everything they can to confuse you about it. We'll be back with your calls after this. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. The place where being progressive never felt so good.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. If I seem edgy, I want you to know that I never mean to take it out on you. Life has its problems, and I get my shit. And that's one thing I never mean to do.
Oh, what a great old song. Flashback to my teenage years. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. Yes. By the way, heads up. Tomorrow night, October 6th, Town Hall, Elliott Bay Book Company sponsoring. I'll be doing a rant and a signing about Screwed, the undeclared war against the American middle class and what we can do about it. The tickets are $5. Elliott Bay, 206-624-6600, the phone number, Elliott Bay Books. Or you can just stop by Elliott Bay Books and pick up your tickets. Seattle Town Hall is located on 8th Avenue at Seneca. That'll be tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. in Seattle. And Friday, October 27th, which is, what, 3 weeks hence, I believe, from 7 to 9 p.m. in San Francisco. Stephanie Miller, Rachel Maddow, and Johnny Steele and I will be debating conservatives Jack Armstrong, Joe Getty, Jerry Doyle, and Rusty Humphreys. The debate will be moderated by the Honorable Willie Brown. And that is free and open to the public. The tickets are available at quakeradio.com, sponsored by KQKE, the Quake in San Francisco, which carries this program. And quakeradio.com, the place where you can get the tickets for that. So, all the weird stuff that's going on. Greg Gorman with Talk Radio News, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. I am continually mystified slash horrified by this. Let me just play an audio clip for you, Greg, and I want to get your take on where these guys are going with this.
Sure.
This is from CBS News last night, Katie Couric.
Just a few hours after Kirk Fordham resigned as chief of staff to Tom Reynolds, the House Republican campaign chairman, Fordham told the Associated Press that he had more than one conversation with senior staff at the highest level. That means Hastert staff. Fordham was once a top aide to Mark Foley and is known to be gay.
Now, bingo. Now, they're starting this whole thing of trying to conflate pedophilia with gay. She continues. I mean, this is the worst, in my opinion, the worst kind of slash and burn. Anyway, let me just...
CBS News has learned that several other top Republican staffers handled the Foley matter are also gay.
Oh, my God!
Their role in this controversy has caused a firestorm among Republican conservatives, who charged that a group of high-level gay Republican staffers were protecting a gay Republican congressman.
And then they go to Tony Perkins.
Was the leadership afraid to stand up to that network out of fear of being labeled homophobic or gay bashing?
So here what we have are the Republicans. Yeah, right. What we have are the Republicans trying to take a guy who's a pedophile and use it to paint... To bash, to trying to turn this into it's all about gay or not gay, when there's no relation between the two. In fact, the vast majority of children who are molested in the United States are molested by straight white men.
Tom, I wish you would go around on all day, as many times as you can, say that over and over to your listeners. I'm going to put a little bit, of editorial here and say that I've been sick and tired of this argument now for a while here in Washington. It's now bubbling up to the worst levels. I've heard more than one person, even on the street, gay equals pedophile. Or,
yeah, this
you know,
has
gay
nothing
equals
to,
bad. Or
this
gay
has nothing
women.
To do with being gay.
It has absolutely nothing to do with gay. And I knew it was going to go south as soon as Mark Foley's lawyer made the announcement that he was gay, as if it was a curse. And I could tell the way he said it, and yeah. I could tell the way that he he sort of threw it in with, he's an alcoholic, he was abused by a priest, and he's gay. Sort of,
right.
You know, like this triumvirate of evil, if you will.
And right, and in fact, if he's gay, he obviously wasn't born that way. The priest made him that way.
Well, you know
so
what?
So it feeds into that whole hysteria.
And right, and that's what, and that's what's going on. It's, some kind of crazy gay hysteria. And if it plays well, shame on the Republicans and shame on anyone that buys into it.
Well,
you know, it's 2006,
actually...
and people need to know that it has nothing to do, one has nothing to do with the other.
Absolutely. But the Republicans have another 4.5 weeks to spin this thing. And I have a feeling that they are going to succeed in spinning this thing around to where they may even, it's probably too late to get them on the ballots, but they probably have anti-gay measures on ballots in some states where they may actually be able to use this to mobilize their base.
Well, as you have probably heard, Howard Dean is now finally coming out after, 3 days?
No pun intended.
Pretty, right, no pun intended. He's actually made some pretty harsh statements, about how the Republicans are, bad on everything, the war, and they're bad on natural disasters, and that, they're bad on defending America, and they're bad on keeping our kids safe. However, he said nothing about this gay issue. And,
yeah.
I would personally like Howard Dean to come out and say that, it's absolutely dirty, awful politics if you're trying to equate being gay with being a pedophile. He hasn't done that yet, but, there's still a chance for the Democrats to do
that. Well, there's a number of Democrats who have. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has said that, has she not? I'm misremembering.
Well, I think she did, and also I know that on CNN, one of the news anchors who I happened to catch tried to do that as well. However, as you can imagine, on Fox News, they have not made any issue of it. In fact, they kind of ignored it.
On Fox News, they've got Mark Foley,
as
D-FL.
A Democrat.
As
a Democrat.
I mean, it's
three different times.
Crazy.
Three different times.
Crazy.
Yeah,
right. And the AP even picked it up twice yesterday. Brad Friedman is blogging it. A couple of AP stories that identified Foley as a Democrat as well.
I think it's subtle and it's dirty.
Yeah, well said. Greg Gorman, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks for being with us here, Greg.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Always great having you on the program. 56 minutes past the hour, a place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election. You know, we'd really settle for that. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So how'd they do it? How is it that 10 million more Americans are voted for Democrats in the United States Senate than voted for Republicans, and yet Republicans hold a majority? Well, actually, that number assumes that all the voting machines were normal and no elections were rigged. That's just because small states, small conservative rural states, have two senators, just like great big progressive states like California and New York. But then there's the other part of it. How is it that George W. Bush got appointed by the Supreme Court? How is it that, you know, how do these guys, how you look around America and you say, nobody is in sync with this, with the agendas of these people. Nobody wants Social Security privatized, a very small lunatic fringe. Nobody wants the minimum wage kept at $5.15 an hour. Nobody wants to see unions destroyed. Nobody wants to see our water more polluted, our air more polluted, our forests cut down, our environment destroyed, the global warming unchecked. Nobody wants to see this, and yet that's the policy of the United States government. How can it be? Sasha Abramski has perhaps an answer. Mother Jones magazine, motherjones.com, the website. She's the author of Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote. How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. You've been on the program before. I'm sorry I got the pronoun wrong there.
That's fine.
Great to have you back with us. How did we get conned here, Sasha?
Well, in my book, I talk about the whole issue of felon disenfranchisement, which is that if you get a felony record, not just for a really, really serious felony, but for a relatively minor offense, let's say you're a teenager, you get caught up in the criminal justice system on a low-end drug offense, and you happen to live in a state like Florida or Mississippi, in those states, if you get a felony, you forever lose the right to vote. And because we're now putting more and more people in prison, at the back end of the system, we're taking away the vote from more and more low-income Americans. And at this point in time, we've taken away the vote from 5 or 6 million people, which is a huge number of people. And they're generally low-income. Disproportionate number of them come from African-American or Latino backgrounds. These are groupings that statistically are more likely to vote Democratic. As you take more and more of these people out of the political process, you skew the remaining electorate in a more conservative direction. So I think one thing that's happened is we've just shrunk the suffrage. In my magazine article for Mother Jones, I talk about other things. I talk about ways in which machines have malfunctioned, ways in which poor people voting in poor neighborhoods have to wait for many, many hours to cast their ballots because there aren't enough machines, ways in which machines have begun counting votes backwards and giving votes to the wrong candidates. I talk about ways in which old-fashioned voter intimidation still takes place. So I think there are many, many issues that are going on around the country that cumulatively are resulting in a very, very flawed election process.
So what do we do about it?
Well, I think one of the things we need to do is just understand what's happening. A lot of the worst excesses go on without anybody understanding what's happening. And as long as that's the case, as long as voters aren't getting outraged about the fact that their votes are being diluted by very, very nefarious manipulations of the system, unless you have the voter outrage, that's going to continue. When you do have the voter outrage, when you do have some kind of public interest to change this, that's when you begin to get laws put in place to try and restrict the manipulation of the process.
But here's the problem. We're talking with Sasha Abramsky.
Abramsky.
MotherJones.com, the new article, and also the author of Conned, How Millions Went to Prison, Lost the Vote, and Helped Send George W. Bush to the White House, from the New Press. The article in Mother Jones called Just Try Voting Here, MotherJones.com. Here's the problem. If the felons in Florida collectively said, and this is a significant proportion of the electorate in Florida, actually.
It's about 8% at this point.
Yeah, we're to collectively say, we're mad as hell and we're not going to do it. You know, we're not going to take this anymore. What are they can't vote the bums out of office. I mean, they have lost the right to have any kind of political pressure. So how do you, you know, and I don't think that there's a lot of sympathy in general for felons, tragically.
I think it's a matter of how you define the issue. If you talk about the issue in terms of criminals wanting the vote, you're right, there's not a lot of sympathy out there for the criminal element in society. If you redefine it and say this isn't about criminal justice, but it's about social justice, it's about people who've done their time, have been deemed rehabilitated, are out in the community paying taxes, are expected to obey all of the laws, and yet they have no say in the system. They can't vote. They can't sit on juries. They can't determine who runs the school boards for the schools their children attend. If you redefine it that way, I think you begin to see much more public sympathy. When you look at opinion polls on this, nationally, the majority of people favor allowing ex-felons who've served their time to vote. Now, you're right that it's very, very hard to vote the bums out of office when a significant percentage of people can't vote. But there are still many, many people who do care about these issues who do vote. And I think you have to appeal to the better ideals that are still present in American politics.
Well, what about lobbying secretaries of state?
Well, I mean, I guess you could. And if you look at my article in Mother Jones, one of the things I write about is that secretaries of state definitionally are part of the partisan process. They're elected officials, they represent one party. Oftentimes, their position is a jumping-off point. They want to run for higher office. They want to run for Senate. They want to run for the governorship, etc. And so oftentimes, you'll find that secretaries of state are just as much a part of the problem as anything else. If you look at a state like Ohio...
Ken Blackwell,
exactly. He's been going out of his way for the last many years to limit access to the vote. And I'll give you one example because it struck me as so absurd. A few years ago, he was looking for any and every way to make it more difficult for new, young, presumably Democratic voters to register to vote. And he got the bright idea that he would only accept voter registration forms printed out on 80-pound paper. Now, when you go to Staples and you go to buy paper for your printer, you buy 20-pound paper. You buy just regular paper. 80-pound paper is the extremely thick cardboard.
It's like the cover of a fancy magazine.
That's right. It's impossible to find anywhere, and even if you did find it, it would cost a fortune. Now, for some reason, Ken Blackwell decided he would only accept voter registration forms off on this extraordinarily expensive paper. And it made no sense. No other Secretary of State in the country had done this. There was no objective reason to do it. It was a completely arbitrary decision designed to make it harder to register to vote. Now, in the end, this got so much ridicule that he was forced to withdraw it, but it sort of goes to show that the secretaries of state, the people you expect to be responsible for managing a fair, evenly run process, oftentimes are actually going out of their way to make the process as skewed as possible. It's a really difficult system to overturn because it's hardwired into state constitutions that the secretary of state is going to be elected and the secretary of state is going to run elections.
Our system has been so corrupted by a series of things like this, and then you get the Supreme Court deciding that if money equals free speech and you know, corporations are persons and all this other nonsense, and so excuse me, it's impossible to regulate that, and it's just, I mean, we need a fundamental rethinking of this entire thing from the ground up.
Yeah, I think we do. We need to be looking at ways to re-engage people in the political process. We need to be looking for incentives we can give people to participate politically instead of going out of our way to discourage people from participation. I've talked with people from Australia recently, and in Australia you have a system where if you don't vote, you get fined.
Yeah,
and if
$25.
You don't vote, That's right. And if you don't vote a second time, you get a bigger fine. And if you don't vote a third time, you get an even bigger fine. And the result of this is that they have almost universal political participation. Now, that doesn't mean everybody who votes is happy about voting, nor does it mean everybody who votes is happy about the candidates on offer. But it does produce this continued involvement with the political process. Now, I'm not sure that's the answer here, but I do think we need to be looking for very, very creative political ways of re-engaging our citizenry in the process.
Yeah, I mean, one way, I don't think that we could, frankly, I don't think it would pass constitutional muster to require people to vote.
No,
but
I don't think it would.
But what we could do is we could offer a tax break to people who vote.
Well, we could offer a tax break to people who voted. We could offer an electoral system that has elections on weekends instead of weekdays, because at the moment we have the elections on a Tuesday,
right.
And if you're a low-income person, you're paid an hourly wage, and you have no job security, and you live in a precinct where you're likely to wait 3 or 4 hours to vote because there's a shortage of machinery, that's a huge disincentive to vote. If you had the election on a weekend, probably you could significantly raise political participation just by doing that. Another thing that some people have begun talking about, which is a gimmick, but it might work, is linking a lottery system into voting. So everybody who voted would get a ticket with a number on it, and a few people at the end of the day would win quite a lot of money. It would just be a part of the lottery. Now, again, it's a gimmick, but it might be a way to re-engage people politically. And once they begin voting, then it might become a habit, and they might vote more regularly, as opposed to at the moment where the habit is, oh, I can't be bothered, it's too much effort, why vote, the system's stacked against me.
Yeah, although most of the people who use lotteries in the United States are probably people who would vote Republican. They're the rural poor.
I haven't looked at the numbers there.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Sasha Abramsky, the article over in MotherJones.com, just try voting here. Thanks for being with us, Sasha.
Oh, my pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now listen. I watched the news last night on TV. Another scandal up there in D.C. Jack Abramoff, Duke Cunningham, Tom DeLay. Well, there's a new one most every other day. And you got Halliburton camped out in the lobby, making handshake deals behind closed doors. You better do something fast about the price of gas, cause I've been paying for mine and for yours, and I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends. We're going to take our country back one congressional district at a time. Our Taking My Country Back segment here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Bill Morrison is with us. He's running for Congress in Tennessee's 7th District. The website, Morrison, M-O-R-R-I-S-O-N, 4, F-O-R, Tennessee, T-E-N-N-E-S-S-E-E, for those of you who missed that in elementary school, .com. Hey, Bill Morrison, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. We're glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Tell us about the race that you're in.
Well, we're running against Marshall Blackburn in Congressional District 7 here in Tennessee. Makes up 15 counties, Tom, and she is just convinced because of gerrymandering that she can win this election. And we have been in every county shaking hands, and people are dissatisfied with the Republicans, that are dissatisfied with her leadership, or should we say lack thereof. And we just believe that we're going to take this back one vote at a time, and we're going to win it because, quite frankly, we represent the Tennessee values and represent the Tennessee workers in this district.
That's great. And I want to say to my listeners all across the United States, if your local representative is safe and you're looking for a place to send a campaign contribution or to help out, now I notice my call screen software here, it says that another website for you is VoteBillMorrison.com.
Yes, sir, VoteBillMorrison.com, and you can contribute to us through ActBlue.
Okay, great. But I'm assuming that you can do that by going to VoteBillMorrison.com, right?
Yes, sir,
okay.
Absolutely.
So tell us what, you said you represent the working people of Tennessee. What, for example, are, in your mind, the biggest issues facing the people of Tennessee right now?
Well, the biggest issues facing the people in Tennessee is we don't have industry coming to the state, specifically District 7. We have a representative who is free trade. And, Tom, what we have told people all over this district is free trade is a good thing, and economically we need it. The problem is the agreements that this Republican Congress signs and supports are we're trading jobs for their goods. And that's not free, and that's not fair, because it costs the American economy, it costs the American families, and then it snowballs. This Republican Congress has turned their back on college. They've turned their back on education. Tennessee is incredibly high with the high school dropout rate. There's no plan in place from the federal government to do anything about it. They won't fund the mandates. And it's very personal to me, Tom, because I'm a school teacher. I teach middle school, seventh grade, social studies, where we talk about government and history. And it's just slipping away, and the Republican Congress continues to ignore it. And that's the only answer they have, is we're just going to ignore it, and you're going to reelect us because for some reason they think they're just right, and they're not. The Democrats stand firm with the people in this state, with the people in this district, and we want to take the House back and put the voice back into the American people, not big lobbyists.
We're talking with Bill Morrison. Vote Bill Morrison, MORRISON.com, the website. The 7th District of Tennessee, Democrat running for the United States House of Representatives. And energy policy, Bill. What should we do about here we are. We just passed this huge energy bill where we're giving about $10 billion in your tax dollars and mine to big oil companies at the same time that these guys are retiring with $450 million pensions. What do we do about this?
Right, we have to invest back into our own country and invest in our technology. Tennessee, particularly here in District 7, Tom, we are set for biofuel. We have a huge agricultural economy here in District 7 that could just pump millions back into this economy, not only in this state, but in this country. But the Republicans don't see it that way. They think it's best to send the money to someone else who can hold us hostage, and that's what they've done. These other foreign countries have held us hostage, and we have to bow down to them. That's not the America that I'm proud of. The America that I'm proud of is when we are creating our own technology, we're being innovative. You know, John Kennedy started with the space program. We could revitalize this nation with a conservative energy policy where we invest in this country, biofuels, and we give the consumers an alternative. It amazes me here in Tennessee where 2 weeks ago gas was 270, today it's 207. Someone tell me how this gas price drops that quick and continues to drop the closer we get to elections when Republicans are concerned about their control in Congress.
Well, you'll recall back in 2004, George Bush was kind of caught on tape, as it were. CNN had it. They were talking about it a couple of days ago, right after the election, where he publicly thanked Prince Bandar for flooding the market just before the election with oil so that the price of gas would go down in the election year.
Oh, absolutely, and it's happening again, and we as the voters have got to stand up and say enough is enough.
I mean, we've got our elections right now being manipulated by Saudis who don't even run a democratic society. They have, you know, public beheadings every Friday in Jeddah and Riyadh. It's nuts.
It is. It's absolutely nuts, and we are just pushing, and quite frankly, if for some reason the Republicans hold on to this, the American people have got to be ready for a blank check, because that's what we're going to tell them. And I promise you, on November 8th, when you wake up, gas prices are going to be back to $3 a gallon.
Yeah, or within a few weeks thereafter.
You better believe it. Absolutely, Tom.
Bill Morrison. Vote Bill Morrison. MORRISON. VoteBillMorrison.com, the website. Bill, good luck.
Thank you so much, Tom. My pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I feel like every train is coming. I wish I knew the reason why. Why do I feel like running?
Yeah, well, maybe that freight train is called electronic voting machines. I don't know. But we need to get out in such huge numbers and such significant ways that nobody, can question what happened, and then they'll be able to say, well, the excuse is that this Mark Foley thing happened. That's what it's all about. Yeah, whatever. Nonetheless, I don't care what excuse they use for having lost. The reality is that the cons in America are completely out of sync with the American people. This, I mean, the whole idea that Mark Hanna had back in 1896, Mark Hanna, advisor to President McKinley, said, you know, you're not all that popular. You're, you know, the people, 90% of the people in America are now below the poverty line. People are angry. The farmers are organizing. They've created this thing called the Grange. The workers are organizing. They've created a bunch of unions. The most outspoken is they call it the Wobblies, United Workers of the World. I mean, we've got all these unions out here. We've got the progressives. We've got populists. We've got people are calling for universal suffrage for women so that women will be able to vote, because they think that if women are able to vote, then they will vote in favor of things that will change the economic landscape and help families. We can't allow this. I mean, these guys have been reading Karl Marx. How do we distract their attention? Well, McKinley says, I've been having this conversation with this guy who owns this mansion out on the West Coast called Sam Simeon. You know, maybe you've heard of him, William Randolph Hearst. And he says, give me the war and I'll give you the publicity. I'll sell it to the American people. And Mark Hanna says, well, the USS Maine was just, you know, the boiler just blew up and the ship sank in the harbor in Havana. Let's say that the Spanish did it. We'll start a war with Spain. That'll distract people from their problems at home. That'll distract people from the fact that they can't afford, you know, health insurance, that they can't pay for food, that their elderly are dying of starvation in the summer and freezing to death in the winter. And sure enough, it did. It got McKinley reelected. And Karl Rove comes along and says, yeah, I'm going to pattern myself after Mark Hanna, McKinley's advisor. He was a good man. He knew how to keep a Republican president in office. And we were in the Philippines 40 years fighting a guerrilla insurgency. 40 years. And arguably the only thing that ended that, well, actually, you could argue that that insurgency hasn't ended. There are still guerrillas in the outlying islands, which represent about half of the total landmass of the Philippines, who are still fighting us. And they're still fighting U.S. soldiers. But Bush thought, well, yeah, we can do this. We'll do the same thing that McKinley did. Yeah, that'll work just fine. And it's going to work. It won't, you know, it won't be 40 years like it was in the Spanish-American War. No, it's going to be, we're going to do it like Reagan did. He was really good at this. Look at what he did in Panama. Now, you know, that bounced him out 15, 20 points in the polls. You go in, not Panama, excuse me, in Grenada. You go in and knock down a little country, rescue a few American students who didn't know that they were in danger. And you got a little war. And, you know, I mean, look at it. It worked really well for Maggie Thatcher in the Falkland Islands. This in the New York Times. Republicans in Congress have put down a quiet marker in the apparent hope that VI Day might be only months away. VI, victory in Iraq, tucked away in fine print in the military spending bill for this past year, was a lump sum of $20 million to pay for a celebration in the nation's capital, quote, for commemoration of success, end quote, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not surprisingly, the money was not spent. Now congressional Republicans are saying maybe next year. Paragraph written into spending legislation and approved by the Senate and House allows that $20 million to be rolled over into 2007. Ever the optimists. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, our website. If you want to drop into our live chat room, just click live chat, participate in our message boards, you can click that. Articles on democracy will give you all of my writings and ravings about these topics. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, we welcome you tomorrow to our humble city here.
Thank you. I am so looking forward to being at Town Hall in Seattle tomorrow, and people can pick up tickets down at Elliott Bay Bookstore.
It's beautiful. It's fall here. It's just beautiful. In your latest book, you make a statement, the most fundamental tool of activism is communication.
Yeah.
And then it goes on, the importance of the powerful committees, the chairs, and even though that we're not from their districts, that we need to remind them that we are Americans. And everything that they do affects us. So indeed, they do represent us and should hear our voice.
Right.
Which leads me into last Saturday on C-SPAN, they had a confirmation hearing for Michael Wallace, who was a Bush appointee for the Fifth Circuit. And it was very, very insightful. There was just a portion of it in Specter and Kennedy, but mostly Specter was the one with the questions. And Mr. Wallace came out without any hesitation when he was asked about his history, said that he's worked his most of his life in the Mississippi Republican Party. And then he went on and said that he was currently an active member in the Republican Party. So I listened and I was wondering if anyone was going to challenge him, and they didn't. But he went on then, without blinking an eye, to state that he had worked in his church to create the Christian Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second part of this is Specter got into a letter that he had received, well, the committee, Judiciary Committee, received on September 14th from the American Bar Association. And in that letter, it said that Mr. Wallace was not a member of the bar and that they had actually given him a rating that was called a, quote, non-qualified rate.
Hmm.
And then Specter went on with different pages from the American Bar Association listing things as not free from bias or personal views, not open to the socially weak, not yielding to facts.
What's the bottom line here, Jude?
Well, I would encourage people to call and not be afraid, especially all the members on the committee. And they
you mean like to call Arlen Specter and say, yeah, I know you're from Pennsylvania, but you're the chairman of the committee, so you represent everybody in America. I can call you just as well, even though I live in Portland or Seattle.
Absolutely,
or,
and it's under Senate.gov, and they can get into Judiciary Committee and really speak to these individuals.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Well said. Thank you very much, Jude, for the call and for the heads up. June in Yelm, Washington. Hey, June.
Yes. We were having a little argument at home here. Mr. Limbaugh started the argument on the FISA rule on King George spying us.
Right.
And he could spy on us for 3 days before he could get a warrant, right?
That's correct.
And now he don't want no days or nothing. He just wants to spy on us. Am I correct?
That's correct, yes. In fact, that's what he's been doing ever since he became president.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
The original spin from the Republican Party was that's what he's been doing since 9/11, but we now know that he was doing that as early as June of 2001. Yeah. Rather.
Oh, and thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We listen to you every day.
Great. Well, thank you
Bye-bye.
Very much. Bye now. And in fact, June, if you want more information on that, go to a Google search engine and plug in Judge Anna. Well, actually, if you go to TomHartmann.com and click Articles on Democracy, 2-3 articles down, there's a whole piece that I wrote about it. It has a link to the actual decision in which Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit, in the Court of Appeals there, or the Circuit Court there, ruled that George Bush not only had broken the Constitution, had violated his oath of office. He swore an oath to uphold the Constitution. Not only had violated the Constitution, but also had violated the FISA law and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that law requires that anybody who violates it, any federal officer who violates it, go to prison for 5 years for each violation. And Bush is bragging about how he violated this. And it's mind-boggling. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. I'm wondering, how can we, is there any way that we can tweak our system so that we don't keep going through this extremely frustrating repeating cycle of, every 30 years, this power struggle that seems to be going on? Your last guest, I realized that maybe part of the answer to my own question is that we need to maintain our system at the fundamental level of voter election fairness and also campaign finance reform. But is there something that we need in our system that we don't have to permanently keep us from going, you know, two steps forward and 10 steps back and having to clean up messes every 30 years?
Yeah, there is, actually. And it's the end of the doctrine, which started in 1886, which led to the first rise of the corporate power in the United States of what's called corporate personhood, the idea that a corporation is a person and should have the same rights as persons. And I wrote an entire book about this. It's called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And it turns out that the Supreme Court decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad in 1886, did not rule that corporations are persons, even though the Supreme Court has said ever since then that they did rule that. They didn't. And we need to roll that thing back. We need to roll it back either legislatively or judicially. And there are over 100 communities in Pennsylvania now that have passed laws saying corporations are not persons in our town. We need to do more of that. Time for our progressive pop quiz. Our question for today, a paragraph was written in the spending legislation approved by the Senate and House, $20 million for the celebration of what? The sixth caller, 1-866-440-8466, gets an autographed copy of Screwed, 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Congratulations, we have a winner for our progressive pop quiz. Our question was, a paragraph written into spending legislation and approved by the Senate and House allows $20 million for the celebration of what? And congratulations to Greg Cranston in Seattle, Washington. Greg knew that the answer is the commemoration or celebration in Washington, D.C. of success in Iraq and Afghanistan. Isn't that sweet? Me. And just a quick heads up, tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m., Town Hall, Elliott Bay Book Company is putting this thing on. Tickets are available in advance at Elliott Bay. They're $5. You can call Elliott Bay Books at 206-624-6600 if you're in the Seattle area. And I'll be up there tomorrow night. And then on the 27th, we'll be in San Francisco. You can get information about that at quakeradio.com. I'll be part of a debate with Rachel Maddow. And it's going to be a whole bunch of great folks. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, our website, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
First of all, you know, I got cheated. I knew the answer that you're going to forward.
Oh, and you were on hold.
But I was on hold.
I'm sorry. Try better luck next time.
Well, what I want to remind the people in Pennsylvania is that Rick Santorum, who is running for re-election, is in charge of the lobbyist office at 321.
Yeah, the K Street Project.
K Street. And they keep extorting the labor lobbyists take their Democrat lobbyists out of there and put Republicans in, or no labor bills will get passed in Congress and Senate.
Yep.
And I hope that every living Pennsylvanian votes against Rick Santorum.
Yeah.
You know,
Rick Santorum is so toxic to democracy.
Well, he's a cancer in our country.
Yeah, there's nothing partisan about what I am saying. I mean, if he was a Democrat, I would say the exact same thing. This has nothing to do with partisan politics.
He goes to the religious right, and anything that Bush says, you know, is right on line with him. He has no shame.
Yeah, and he's a very strange guy. Very strange. Anybody who would bring home a 20-week-old miscarriage and show it to their other young children and say, "Here's your brother," weird.
Not only that, you know, look how he's pushing for tort reform, and yet his wife sued the their chiropractor or someone, their dentist, you know, for a full month. Oh, boy, what a, you know.
I know, you can't say
how bad that man is.
I know. It's pretty grim. Jim, thanks a lot for that.
Okay, thank you.
It. Good to hear from you. In Philadelphia, Fritz on the line. Hey, Fritz, what's on your mind today?
All right, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Fritz.
There was something I read in the Washington Post yesterday called When the House Could Clean Itself by Joseph Califano. It's about how Tip O'Neill handled the Page sexual abuse thing in 1982.
This is when Jerry Studs, the Democrat, was found actually having sex with a 17-year-old Page, which was not below the age of consent, so it was not illegal, but it was still something that was considered very, very wrong.
Well, yeah, and I'm not saying that it wasn't wrong. Just the way that Tip O'Neill handled it within the House to protect the integrity of the House. He let the chips fall where they may, but had to clean his house instead of just sweeping everything underneath the carpet. It's very good reading. I put it on your
What specifically did Tip O'Neill do, Fritz?
Well, within a week, he had set up a commission to review everything. Rudolph Giuliani was involved with it.
Okay, so Denny Hastert says that he has just done that. He's put Louis Freeh, the former Republican director of the FBI that Bill Clinton brought in, actually. Clinton wanted to have a bipartisan administration. He made the mistake of putting a partisan Republican in charge of the FBI, so Louis Freeh helped set up his the impeachment of Bill Clinton. But in any case, he put Denny Hastert says he's going to put Louis Freeh in charge of an investigation.
Well, that's all well and good. He's done that after, what, 1, 2, 3 years? We're not even sure. Tip O'Neill did it within a week.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. There was no, he wanted to find out what was going on before, and then released everything.
This was within a week of it going public, or within a week of him finding out?
Within a week of him finding out.
And how long after that did it go public?
You know, it doesn't, well, let's see, it's quite an article, actually.
Yeah, I'll have to read the whole thing.
Yeah, it is. It's posted on your message board as I put in the House of the Mass.
Great. I'll check it out, Fritz, when we get off the air. Thanks
all
for the call.
You.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And let's see here, Neil in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Neil.
Hey, Tom. You're quite a hero. I'd like to remind you and our listeners to keep the meme alive that we have a chance now to put forward the values that we've had for so long, values that have been forgotten since 2000. It's easy to get lost in this scandal or in the 911 picture, but just to remind everybody, it's in the nature of a prayer that you hold the vision of what you want the future to be. What we have coming up for us is this extraordinary chance, a great chance to bring forward these values that we all really believe in, the values of democracy or of basic equality and everybody getting a fair shake. And I think that you've been a great proponent for that. But I think every one of us who's listening to you now, we just have this responsibility on ourselves now to step forward into what you see, the world you want to be.
Well said. Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate the call.
Yep. Today it's the 5th. People are out on the streets. I'm going down to the protest here in Portland as soon as I get off the air. So I also think we need a national day of prayer and fasting, frankly. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. And more of the rest of the news, congressional Republicans, tangled webs and all that. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.